Smithville, Missouri is a town of about 10,000, so it's not a small town per se, but it's got that small town feel. Most of the mom and pop shops on Main Street keep irregular hours, so it can be quiet on a weekday. There's Nellie's Sweet Shop, that's S-H-O-P-P-E, Jean's Flowers and Gifts, a few antique stores and bars. Of course, you've got your Chamber of Commerce, City Hall, the Basics, and then there's Justice Drugstore. It looks like a quaint old pharmacy, but it's a restaurant run by Jonathan Justice, and it's really put Smithville on the map. People drive long distances to sample menu items like the house rabbit sausage with warm tarragon vinaigrette and duck yolk with shaved cauliflower.
Jonathan's more of a fancier restaurant. I'm a hamburger guy, so.
Bum Williams has been running his Smithville barbershop for 48 years. Jim Lockey, another local, is also a burger guy.
On the weekends when they're open, in the evenings, you get a lot more downtown traffic. It ain't nothing to see limousines parked all up and down that little old road, which is kind of weird for this small town. But
well, it's hard to believe since we all remember the old drugstore and what used to be there, but no, I think he's real successful.
That's Carol Schaefer. She works across the way at Shireen's Hair Etc., where she and the other stylists talk about Jonathan. They've known him since he was a kid, and Shireen herself has an offer for the chef.
If he ever wants to shave that beard off, I would do it free. I know he's up for some beard award, so I figured he's going with the whole thing, the whole package.
It's true. Jonathan Justice is a semi-finalist for a James Beard Award in the chef category. Finalists will be announced next week at a ceremony in San Francisco. That's a really big deal. And even though I'm pretty sure it has nothing to do with facial hair, he's sitting in front of me now. And Jonathan, your beard is, well, it's quite nice. It's not as untamed as I had been perhaps led to believe.
Good morning, Gina. How you doing?
Good.
My beard is in a more subdued state at the moment than it's been at times.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and the rest of today's Central Standard on KCUR is a portrait session with Chef Jonathan Justice. Jonathan, we just heard a snippet of life in Smithville, the town where you grew up, where your family ran a pharmacy for generations, and where you now operate a restaurant that's drawn national attention. It's kind of a schlep for the fine dining crowd of Kansas City, but it must mean something to you to have this restaurant in Smithville and in a business, in a place that housed your family business.
You know, Gina, that property where the restaurant is has been in my family since April of 1840. That means next month it would have been 176 years. It was never really my fantasy or dream to come back to the town where I was born and grew up to open a restaurant. It was more serendipity. And when it presented itself, it wasn't something that I thought, oh, great, let's do this. It was, I had a very strong anti-reaction to the idea in the beginning.
So, I mean, you had, was it your idea?
No.
Really? Okay, tell me about that.
Well, my wife and I were coming back from our second time of living in France, and I'd been an executive chef in the south of France in a city called Le Grand Mot. And my parents were older when I was born, so whenever, if we were going to be out of the country for any amount of time, I would stop through Kansas City and Smithville and visit, and always wondering if that could be the last time that I see them. And we were coming back through, and my mother had sold her pharmacy and was leasing the building to another pharmacy. And they moved out 5 years into a 15-year lease, leaving this empty building. And we were on our way to Montreal when my mother and my little sister said, oh, you should put a restaurant in the old drugstore. And what I said in response really isn't fit for the radio.
So where did your thought process go from there?
Well, my wife, who was really an impetus in this, was the one that said, look, I know this is not what you were thinking that we wanted to do, but we'd been talking about a restaurant for a long time. And she said, you know, although I know that no one in your family is going to give you this building, we could probably figure out a way to finance it and buy the building from your family. And she started talking about where the location, the proximity to farms and farm infrastructure, and with while at the same time having a large metropolitan area close enough to support it. And the more we talked about it, the more I kind of researched the area and, like I said, the agriculture, infrastructure, and the demographics of Kansas City and the surrounding area, the more I started to kind of find myself getting more brought into the fold of the idea.
Well, I've heard you describe your food sensibility as country food on steroids. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. When we first opened, I was calling it Oat Midwestern, but...
Like H-A-U-T-E, not O-A-T.
Yeah, that's right. When I'm thinking about the food that I'm doing, and I don't do other people's dishes, I'm really careful to try and do something that is... It's hard to say original because, I mean, what is original? I mean, I think about, does this say what I'm conceiving of, say anything about us as a culture in this area? Does it say anything about this area geographically? My mother grew up on a farm in Weston that actually had been in my family a couple of years longer than where the drugstore is now. And she grew up during the Depression, and her job was once a week. She, among other things, had to kill the chicken, and they... killed processed whole hogs, and you know, you used everything because you had to. It was not because it was just, I mean, it was, people were poor and you couldn't afford to throw away anything. And so when we opened the restaurant, I thought about, I want to do something that is about using the whole animal, that is about using the entire plant, and also I've always had a strong interest in wild foods, so we do a lot of foraging, but that's also transitioned into, we are taking native indigenous plants, and we've got a farm at our house on our property that we are developing modern cultivars out of wild plants. So,
what do you mean by modern cultivars?
Well, let's see. I'll give you an example. Pennycress out in the wild is a bitter little green, but there are some of the plants, if you go out in the woods and you're finding this plant, that have a genetic anomaly where they have a nuttiness to them and a recessive bitter gene instead of the dominant bitter gene. And so I got this brilliant idea that I could just plant the seeds of this genetic anomaly that I found out in the wild. But when I planted that, what I got instead of was a bunch of nutty pennycress, I got down the row bitter, 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 nutty, bitter, 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 nutty. But then we eradicated those bitter.
That sounds like a fun, like, right, way of dividing people you know.
Right. There you go.
The bitter and the nutty.
But if you keep eradicating the bitter, then the nutty will start becoming the dominant gene. Now, we'll never be able to get, just like your friends, all of the bitterness out, because we have cross-pollination with wild plants. We've got it to about 80% nutty and 20% bitter. But that's for an example, that we're trying to breed. Actually, just like, if you want to go back, when as humans we were going from the hunter-gatherer to the agrarian society, we were out picking plants for their flavor, for their capabilities of preservation, for their medicinal values. And when we started planting these in rows, rather than just gathering them, we started breeding the characteristics that we wanted into those plants. And that's basically what we're doing now.
So you're doing it from wild rather than from all these generations of breeding?
Right. Well, all those generations of plants that we use are already cultivars. Now, there's another aspect of this, that when, as Europeans, we came to the New World, we looked at the Native American and said, you are heathens, you are not children of our God and sons of our Jesus, so therefore we're not going to eat what you eat because it's not blessed by our Lord and Savior. And so we ignored most of what was here. If you take corn, beans, potatoes, tomatoes and squash out of our daily diet, everything that we eat is of European descent. And so there is an entire grocery store and cornucopia of food that is out in the woods that has never been brought into that modern cultivation because it wasn't done over millennia in the natural progression that we brought along.
Is there an example of something that you have stumbled upon while foraging that you have introduced into one of your dishes that is pretty unfamiliar, that was an exciting discovery for you?
The aforementioned pennycress was something that I don't see mentioned in foraging books, and so far no one's got sick.
Describe it to me.
Well, describe the dish or the...
Describe the plant, what it looks like, what it smells like, and how you used it.
Well, it's, like I said before, it's kind of bitter but nutty. What does it look like? I tell you, when it goes to seed, it's really easy to distinguish because its seeds are about the size of a penny, and they're very, very flat and thin, with a seed pressed down in the center of it. And they tend to grow in soil that has been recently disturbed. So you see them a lot at construction sites. Another one you see at construction sites a lot is lamb's quarters. And that's got a very mild, almost, think of the flavor of romaine, but not as thick or containing the water content that romaine has.
I watched a video of a talk you gave at an MU Life Sciences conference on food, and you told a story with changed names to protect the innocent about a three-legged pig.
Hey, you're one of 30 people that have seen that YouTube.
Well, would you be willing to tell that story?
Yeah, sure. I was just telling the story the other day. First, I want to apologize to the people whose names I'm getting ready to mention. So out on a two-lane blacktop west of Smithville is KK Highway, and that's where Pat Heath lives. And by the local agent for the farm extension over in Platte County, Bub Miller, was out at his house once and was checking on the farm as he would go around and look at the different farms. And as he came up to Pat's house, he saw that Pat had a brand new house and the old two-story farmhouse was gone and a new modern ranch was in its place. And he saw Pat's truck and he went up to the door and rang the bell and no one was there. And he thought, well, he must not be around. And he was going back to his truck and he sees this three-legged pig come around the corner of the house. And he thinks to himself, well, that's odd. And then as he's getting into his truck, he sees Pat down by the barn in the paddock. And he gets back out of his truck and goes down to meet Pat. And he says, Pat, how you doing? Pat says, well, I'm doing all right. And Bub says, well, it looks like you're doing okay. Farming must be working well for you. You've got a brand new house. And Pat looked at him quizzically and said, you know, Bub, this house was not born out of good fortune. It was born out of tragedy. He said, really? What happened? He says, well, you know, last fall after the harvest, I was upstairs at night. I was sleeping with Lil and the kids, and I woke up and there was this pig in my room, and it was licking my face and snorting at me. And I thought, what the heck? And I opened my eyes and I could smell smoke. And I got Lil up and I ran down and we got the kids and we managed to get down the stairs and get out of the house, and you know, the house burned to the ground. And then Bub says, really, that's amazing. So that pig saved your life. And he said, he saved my entire family's life, Bub. And then Bub says, so that's how he lost his leg? And he says, no, nothing like that at all. I tell you, remember this spring when, you know, it was wet all winter and I was down, I was mowing down in the pasture and I got too close to the pond and my tires that were the closest to the pond, they sunk down in the mud and the tractor flipped over and it trapped my leg down on the inside where my head was just underwater. I could, from below the water, I was looking up and I could see the sky and I could see clouds, but I couldn't get up enough to breathe. And that pig broke out of the paddock, ran down the hill and got his snout up under the back of my head and pushed my head up to where I could breathe. And I started screaming and yelling. And my neighbor over up there on the hill in his barn, Otis St. John, heard the screaming and ran down with a grain shovel and that soft mud extracted my leg and got me out. And I said, you know, that pig saved my life twice. And Bub said, my God, that's amazing. So that's how he lost his leg in that incident. And Pat looked at him and said, Bub, no, you don't eat a good pig like that all at once.
What do you think?
Wait, I want to say one more thing about that. Those names in that story are not, those are real people. And my apologies to Otis St. John, Bub Miller, and Pat Heath.
No, I mean, it's a great story. And I wonder what you think it has to do with the place where you grew up, the place where you operate your restaurant, and the meaning of food there.
Well, you know, that is That's a very good question. Yeah, it was something I noticed when in the introduction, and the people that were being spoken to, those were all people that grew up in Smithville and still live in Smithville. And I was thinking about the divide in accent from the 30 minutes from Smithville to here. And
to Kansas City.
Right. And it was, I mean, it's pretty amazing that town now is a bedroom community, and it's a suburb. But growing up, it was very agrarian. And the accent divide for such a short distance was pretty amazing. I mean, everything, the colloquialisms, the lexicography, it's a different world. And it was. And I think, you know, I've had people be very repulsed by that joke. But I think about my mom again, growing up in Weston, you know, she really wasn't and still isn't someone that is about having pets. Pets were something that you kept outside. Cats were something you had in the barn specifically for mice. It wasn't something that you had for comfort and for companionship. And that was the kind of relationship that she grew up with that you had with animals. But of course, you know, we are living now where it's easy for us to, you know, say, well, we want animals for companionship, because when you live in an affluent society, you can afford that. But in a less affluent society, in a society where survival is more tenuous, your relationship with animals is going to tend to be more about survival.
This is a very unpretentious attitude you have, and I can tell that your restaurant's place in Smithville matters to you, but at the same time, it's an anomaly there. I mean, it draws limos, as we heard someone say, and the burger lovers in the neighborhood don't totally seem on board, you know. And I wonder, you know, as much as you want to connect with this place and the community there, is there a disconnect?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, a few years in, we built a patio with its own kitchen, to where we do what I call bar food, and we do burgers out there, and the burgers are ground fresh every day. They come from the same local farmer that I get my other beef from. We bake our buns from scratch every day. We make our ketchup from scratch. We make all of our mustards and pickles and relishes. They're all made in-house. And I still find that the people that go on that patio there are quite a few locals, but not so much the old-time locals. And I think it's not just that someone can say that they're about a burger, but if you don't feel comfortable in the space, they're not going to go. I mean, the local country restaurants, you know, they bright fluorescent lighting with stackable church chairs and formica tables. And when someone goes into a restaurant, even our patio, which is casual, there's no tablecloths, but we still have cloth napkins. And it's still a little bit of a little fancy for them.
Hold that thought. You're listening to a portrait session with Chef Jonathan Justice of the Justice Drugstore in Smithville. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear more of his personal story. We'll also learn how he paints with flavors. That's coming right up. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show is a portrait session with Jonathan Justice. We've been talking about his restaurant, the Justice Drugstore in Smithville, Missouri, and the unique style of food he serves there. A lot of people marvel that this restaurant, with its locally sourced ingredients and experimental fare, is so far off the beaten path for fine dining. But Smithville is Jonathan's home, and Jonathan, you tell a story about how you first started cooking growing up. Can you tell that story now?
Yes, I don't remember this, but I have the span of my siblings is 25 years. My little sister is 5 years younger than I am, and my oldest sister is 20 years older. So I have four sisters and two brothers. And when I was four, one of my older sisters was home from grad school. It was a Saturday morning, and she found me in the kitchen on one of those old Costco step stools, that the steps that kind of fold out and that you can use as a kid, like a step ladder. And I was standing on top of it, cooking bacon and eggs at a gas stove. And she grabbed me and swept me off of it and went and got my mother and said, Mom, I just found Jonathan in the kitchen cooking bacon and eggs on the stool. And Mom came in and says, yes, he does that every morning.
Do you know how you got started making bacon and eggs so young?
I would say a very laissez-faire approach to child rearing, maybe.
That you were hungry, you knew what you wanted.
Well, you know, I think honestly, I was in the very first generation of kids that had a professional mother. It's very common now, but my mother actually, when she took over the pharmacy from my dad's father, she got a couple of times anonymous hate mail from within the Smithville city limit, you know, with the postmark of Smithville, chastising her for having a man's job and for not being at home taking care of her kids. And that's hard to imagine from today's point of view, but you know, she was definitely was forging new territory. And so, yeah, we had to somewhat take care of ourselves. And the kids actually, because we were so far apart in age, it's not like there was someone 2 years older than you that was taking care of you. My next oldest brother's 6 years older, and my little sister's 5 years younger.
You spent your early adulthood living in other places. You might have just hinted at this, but why did you leave Smithville?
Boy, you know, growing up in the pharmacy, I mean, there was, in high school, there was a rumor that was absolutely not true. It was really, really stupid. I was dating a girl that became the valedictorian of our high school, and her parents told her to stop dating me because there was a rumor going through town that I was a drug dealer and I was taking drugs from the drugstore and distributing them in school, which is an asinine theory. And the local police started harassing me on a very regular basis. And everywhere I went, I could see people were talking to me or talking about me. And I was just really tired of, there was the sewing circle and the liar's club, the gossip, that I really wanted to live somewhere with anonymity. I was in a prominent family in town. Everyone knew me. Everyone knew my business. I remember once, I was really a pretty good student and a decent kid. The one time I tried to skip school, there was an old woman that knitted in her kitchen window that overlooked the school, and I'm leaving the parking lot in my car. She calls down to the drugstore and says, "Ann, I just saw Jonathan leaving the parking lot. Does he have a doctor's appointment?" And that's how much intrusiveness it felt like there was in my life. And then the other thing is that, although it's not that way now, Smithville was a very conservative town, and really at that time, it hung its hat on the ideas of the Confederacy, and I decided at a very early age that wasn't anything that I wanted to be about. And so literally the day after high school, I had my car packed and I moved to Southern California.
So it was in California, I think, that you were a bike messenger?
Yeah, think about this for a second. My mother, you know, was a pharmacist with advanced degrees, and my father had an MBA from Wharton, an Ivy League MBA. And when I was 16 and when I told them I wanted to go to art school, they were not impressed. And so when I first moved out, they said, you know, we think that this is a fad of an idea and that you're going to grow out of it and we don't want to support it. So I moved out to California on my own to go to art school. I graduated from art school and moved up to San Francisco. There weren't a lot of jobs. This was in just after the market crash in late summer 89. And so I actually interviewed for the CIA because they were looking for forgers and engravers to make fake identifications and passports and to counterfeit money to destabilize small governments. It was then George Hubert's administration.
Person I won't name once told me that fraud is fun. It sounds like you were leaning in that direction.
Nah, I decided I couldn't sell my soul. So I ended up repossessing cars for the next 2 years in San Francisco, and not with a tow truck, taking them the old-fashioned way with tools. And I really enjoyed it, but it was hours of boredom and research and stakeouts punctuated with 10 minutes of extreme adrenaline. But after that, I decided I couldn't take a sit-down job, and one of my older sisters was working as a bike messenger in San Francisco. And it's not like you need an inn to get a job as a bike messenger, but that's what I started doing. I ended up doing it for over a 15-year period, but broken up with 2 years living in the south of France painting.
So, yeah, you've got the part bike messenger thing going on, and then this relationship with France. How did that happen?
We really wanted a tale.
And we, as you and your wife?
My wife and I. Camille, by the way, and I should really say, people, because it's got my name on it, talk about the restaurant as being my restaurant. I cannot stress enough that that restaurant, if I were gone for 2 weeks, would hum along fine without me. I have a very well-trained staff. I do cook every day. I mean, I'll go back after this. I'll be prepping all day, and I'll be on the line tonight, and I'll be actually cooking on the line tonight. But if something happened to me, we would be fine. You know, even though the dishes are mine, at some point, something would have to give. But if Camille wasn't there, within 48 hours, there would be nothing but a pile of ash because I don't know how to do anything. She serves every night. That's what we live on. She does all of our business side. And I just want to make sure that people recognize that this is our restaurant and Camille is a huge, huge part of it. So I forgot my ADD.
France.
Oh, France. Thank you. we were living in San Francisco and we were recreationally self-medicating with cocaine and not to to a place where we were not functional. I mean, we got up and worked every day, and not even our closest friends, no one knew. And we felt it was pretty casual, but we also thought, you know, we kind of need to get away and reset ourselves. And Camille was we paid her way through school. She was going to San Francisco State University, and she changed her major from business to French to get a chance to get in a program to do an exchange. And so we moved to Aix-en-Provence, and then after her two semesters were up, we just stayed.
And I hear that your first kitchen job was actually like an under-the-table type gig in Aix-en-Provence?
That's true. All of my kitchen jobs in France were under the table. We were illegal immigrants twice in France. And yeah, that was... and something happened. When I first got into the kitchen, there was this social camaraderie that was going on. And my life up to that point, spending hours and hours in my studio painting and working as a bike messenger and as a repo, these are disciplines of solitary confinement. When I got into the kitchen, I suddenly realized that wow, I don't like myself enough to spend that much time alone. And then secondarily, then I realized pretty quickly that I'd never really thought about that, because as Americans, we tend to, you go out and you're like, okay, I'm going to have a salad and I want this dressing on it. And I want, you know, everything is kind of, you kind of build your own thing.
Very customized.
But in France, these are compositions and very specific things go with each other. And the classic dishes, of course, have stood the test of time. And I started thinking of a plate of food and then a meal as a composition.
Like an artistic composition.
And much more complicated than painting. And I felt like that was something that I could spend a life's work working on.
Can you explain that more to me? How do you, I mean, it sounds like you're talking about painting with flavors, but maybe there's also a visual component to it. But,
you know, I look at flavors as colors, and I always have. You've got in colors the classic red, yellow, blue, black, and white. And then flavor, you've got salt, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami being savory. And you have saturations, if you think of like bright, bright yellow or dilution of yellow. Or if you think of acid, like say squeezing a lemon into your mouth or squeezing a few drops into a glass of water, that's saturation and dilution. You have contextual. Say green is a warm color next to blue, but is a cool color next to yellow, orange, or red. If you take a sautéed onion and put a caramelized onion next to it, most people would say that the sautéed onion is the cool flavor, the caramelized onion is the warm flavor. But you put that sautéed onion next to, say, a raw sweet Vidalia, or that raw sweet Vidalia next to a green onion, or a green onion next to a kiwi, or a kiwi next to a cucumber, or a cucumber next to pine needle, going progressively cooler. What is warm and cool is only within the context of the manifestation of the composition.
So it's just totally relative.
Right. Like, that's crunchy. And you attempt to not thought, well, that's or that's really crunchy. Or that's spicy. You know, that's really spicy. And also within that, your taste buds acclimate. So I remember being very, very small. I got a quarter a week as a to spend in the pharmacy at the drugstore or spend in the soda fountain. And for a nickel, I could get a small Coke. For a nickel, I could get a candy bar. I remember being very young, and I had a, I'm going to spend a dime. That's like a lot of my allowance at once. I took a sip off the Coke. And I was like, oh, that's sweet. And then a bite of the candy bar. Yum, that's delicious. Then you go back to the Coke. I was like, oh. Couldn't stand up to the sweetness of the candy bar. So there's that kind of contextualism also.
Just really quickly, Patrick Ryan at Port Fonda is also a semifinalist for the James Beard Award. Are you guys going to like fight over it or go halfsies if one of you wins?
I will definitely buy him a drink if he wins.
Okay. Our time is up for this portrait session with Chef Jonathan Justice of the Justice Drugstore. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our portrait sessions pair in-depth interviews with photographic portraits by the wonderful Paul Andrews. You can see those on our website later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. The weekend is here, but you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with Fridays by Jen Chen. We get help from interns Coy Duggar and Glenn Frizzell. Special thanks to Andrea Tudhope. Linda Scher runs the board for us. Our music is by Spoonbender Labs. Paul Andrews is our portrait session partner. I'm Gina Kaufman.